Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Shovel ready, pie in the sky.
I don't understand the stimulus money, the spending of the money, the way that they're doing, and I don't think they're actually helping the small little guy like me.
A voter in Florida reflects a general sense of mystery about where all that stimulus money went. What are they shoveling down there in Washington? And when will that brand new bullet train we've heard about be ready to ride? Can you create real jobs when you're building imaginary infrastructure? Dream on. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Friday, March 12th, back in New York from a couple of days down in South Florida at WLRN Miami. We have one more Florida story for you. We just sort of mentioned it there at the top. What if billions of dollars in federal stimulus money just vanished in the Florida Everglades? That's what we're going to talk about a little
bit. I think we're also going to talk a little bit about whether or not Floridians actually know what it is that they want. Mm-hmm. But first, let's get a check of the morning's top news. Thousands of Ground Zero rescue workers who got sick from the dust in the aftermath of the World Trade Center attacks have reached a settlement with the city of New York. The cops, firefighters, and construction workers will share a $657 million settlement. Joe Paulette, who researches the environmental impact of the attack, tells the BBC that thousands of rescuers developed breathing difficulties.
I feel tremendous relief. The Ground Zero workers have had devastating consequences.
A judge still has to sign off on the settlement, and the rescue workers themselves have to agree to it.
Painful milestone today. 2 months ago, an earthquake hit Haiti, leaving over 200,000 dead, millions homeless in one of the worst natural disasters ever in the Western Hemisphere. We're going to talk a little bit about what's going on the ground and how the economy is recovering in Haiti, if it even can. We're joined by Melody Munz, who's an environmental health coordinator for the International Rescue Committee in Haiti. Melody, good morning.
Good morning.
So, Melody, in some sense, the international aid effort is the economy of Haiti right now. Is it able to benefit Haitians on a permanent basis, or will the economy leave when the aid effort leaves?
I think that the aid community is engaging. We are all engaging as many Haitians as we possibly can and in roles that are as close to their previous professional roles. That take advantage of the training they already have and build on that. So, yes, I think that we will actually have something to contribute to the future of Haiti.
All right, well, stay with us, Melody Munz. Coming up, a challenging discussion of how to hire Haitian in the earthquake-devastated zone.
House Democrats will meet again this morning to try to iron out more of the problems on the health care bill. President Obama wants the completed bill on his desk by next week. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, though, says that's unlikely. Also, the president says he'll proceed with an overhaul of the immigration system this year, but only if he can attract substantial Republican support. And remember, unless you live in Arizona or Hawaii, we are going to lose an hour to daylight savings this weekend. The clocks spring forward on Saturday night, and that got us thinking about the whole concept of time, and we have this question for you today. What do you wish there was more time for? Maybe you'd like to debate healthcare more, John.
Oh yeah.
You were saying sleep. What do you want more time for?
This is David from Worcester, Mass. Since this is a fantasy question, I'm going to give you a fantasy answer. If I had an extra hour every day, I would give it away to a terminally ill person because I'd probably waste it anyway.
That's an honest
that's nice.
Answer.
I'd like more time
to cook things from scratch. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can post to our site, thetakeaway.org.
Let's take a look at the markets quickly. A lot of traders would love another hour to trade sometimes.
Yeah.
Asian markets are mixed. European indices are up. Futures are up. So the Dow is going to get underway positively, we think, at 10,611. The S&P will open at 1,150, and the NASDAQ at 2,368. Coming up, our week-long series on genius wraps up with a discussion with David Schenck and some practical tips on how anyone, parents maybe even, can make their kids better at almost anything. That's later on this hour. And in just a few minutes, a conversation based on what you answered the question, what does Haiti need right now? You gave us some answers, and our discussion is motivated directly about that. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. Well, one of the reasons I went down to South Florida this week was to really engage the South Florida community. And, of course, they listened to The Takeaway on WLRN, which is where we were broadcasting from. And it was amazing just how connected South Florida is to Haiti compared with the rest of the United States, although the rest of the United States isn't unconnected, that's for sure. It's definitely been a part of the
aid. Yeah, but there's definitely a very real bond between, immediate bond.
Well, there's signs all over Miami, you know, indicating Haitian sort of contribution zones. If you go to the airport, there are special signs for Haitian charter flights, which have been added since the earthquake. It is 2 months ago today since the earthquake struck Haiti, a nation that we have described multiple times on this program as the poorest, one of the poorest in the Western Hemisphere. It's fair to say that 2 months after the earthquake, the extraordinary aid effort that's gone into Haiti constitutes much of the economy there right now. And the question for our listeners in South Florida, and really for all of you this week, has been, what does Haiti need right now? And a couple of listeners really had this notion that Haiti is a poor country, and the question is all about sustainability in Haiti. They had this very much in mind. Listen.
My name is Paula Tantaloy. I think what Haiti needs right now is jobs, and the best way to do it, we need to go back to our roots, which is agricultural, which we can feed our own people. Until we start feeding our own people, we're still going to have a lot of problems.
Agricultural jobs, that's one challenge. But here, this listener said there's another source of jobs.
I think Haiti can really benefit from the organizations going to Haiti to bring help, UNICEF, Red Cross, you name it. But I hope that they will also hire people in Haiti, Haitians who are qualified, who know the culture, they know the country, give them the opportunity to have a job.
Two listeners who reached us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. So joining us this morning is Franoshka Telemark. She's a Haitian citizen. Good morning, Franoshka.
Good morning.
And you have a brand new job at Oxfam, one of the aid organizations in Haiti, right?
Yes, it's true.
And what department are you working in?
Administration.
You're in administration. And if you look around, are you in the office now?
Well, actually, yes, I'm in the office now.
All right. If you look around, are there a lot of Haitians working with you?
Yes, they are. It's 7 a.m. and everybody's actually booking to their jobs and their work and everything.
And is there a perception among Haitians that the aid organizations need to hire more locally?
I'm not aware of that info because I haven't looked for myself, but I know that everybody who wants to apply for a job in NGO or so, they can do that, and it's open.
It's open. And how long do you expect to have your job with Oxfam?
Well, of course, in all work applications, if you have the skills, it can take 2 weeks to have the job if you're applying. If you have everything, you can have...
No, I understand, but Franoshka, listen carefully. I know we're on a bad phone line here. How long do you expect to have this job here? How long do you expect to be employed by Oxfam?
If you have all your papers that they require for a job, 2 to 3 weeks.
Right, that's how long it takes to get hired. Franoshka Telemark is a Haitian national who's brand newly hired to Oxfam. She didn't quite understand my question there, but Melody Muntz, who joined us a moment ago, Environmental Health Coordinator for the International Rescue Committee in Haiti. Melody, how long can someone like Franoshka expect to have a job, do you think?
Well, for qualified people and people who show progress and basically people who are committed to the project, they will stay with us as long as we are here. Which that is also, that's donor-dependent and project-dependent. So we could be here anywhere from a year to three, even longer years.
And typically, do aid agency jobs, NGO jobs, translate into the broader economy in Haiti, or would it be better to invest in agricultural work and agricultural workers, as one of our listeners suggested?
Well, not to diminish the need for agricultural impact or input. But I think that the NGOs working here, we actually draw from already technically trained people, people with university degrees in sociology, engineering, nurses, medicine, lawyers, people with trades, and we build on those skills. Our teams are comprised entirely of Haitian nationals, and so we identify needs and projects. We work with the team to identify how we're going to solve them. And then they go and implement the program. So I think that they're learning some basic project management. They're getting some confidence in actually making things happen.
So I believe that all of the aid agencies and International Rescue Committee in particular, we are working really hard to build the capacity of the national staff.
It makes our
programs more effective, and it also leaves something behind.
And certainly, I don't mean to sound critical, but I think Melody Muntz, who's with the International Rescue Committee in Haiti, who claims that virtually all of her staff is Haitian nationals, you know, the issue is really troublesome for Haiti, which depends so much on international aid. Franoshka Telemark, down there at Oxfam, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, so let me ask you this question. Do Haitians worry that when the aid effort is finished, that the jobs are going to go away as well?
No, not at all.
So where do the jobs go? Where can you work if Oxfam decides that things are going pretty well in Haiti right now?
Okay. Actually, I have one of my colleagues from administration, and she has more info about that.
Oh, can I talk to her?
Yes, of course.
All right.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your name, ma'am?
My name is Sonia Gelly. I'm the HR manager for the national for Haiti.
All right. And my question to you is, are Haitians worried that when the aid effort stops in Haiti, that the jobs will go away? Where will the jobs come from when the aid effort is over?
Excuse me, but what we are thinking about now is hiring people for at least for 2 years, because the response is going to be at least for more than 1 year. Let's say for finance, we have hired people with open-ended contracts. Where we are working in emergency, like on the field with shelter and everything, we are hiring people for 6 months with possibility of extension. There's no need for them to worry about not being...
Well, thanks so much. The voices of two workers at Oxfam talking about hiring for positions that are really going to be current for 2 years or more. Melody Muntz also joined us. She's Environmental Health Coordinator for the International Rescue Committee in Haiti. So good news, bad news story. Good news is these jobs are going to last for a long time, but it only underscores the severity of the earthquake.
It does, but I heard 6 months to 2 years. Is that what you heard?
That's right. At 15 minutes after the hour, now let's check in on some other stories we're following.
The wife of Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid was seriously injured in a car accident yesterday. Landra Reid broke her back and neck in the crash. Corrine Geller, spokeswoman for the Virginia State Police, says a truck driver was involved.
The driver of the tractor-trailer, 59-year-old Alan Snader of Ohio, was charged with reckless driving. He was not injured in the crash.
Reid's daughter was also in the car. She's been released from the hospital. Later this morning, top House Democrats convene again. They'll try to iron out some of the remaining problems on the proposed health care bill. Meanwhile, there's pressure from the White House to have that bill completed and on the president's desk by March 18th.
Overseas this morning, Israeli authorities sealed off the West Bank. The decision, which restricts the movements of Palestinians, reportedly followed warnings about possible unrest in Jerusalem. Meanwhile, the United Nations top humanitarian official, John Holmes, has criticized Israel. He says linking the capture of an Israeli soldier 4 years ago to the current blockade of Gaza is not right.
The link between that and the fate of the 1.5 million Palestinians in Gaza does not seem to us a reasonable one.
The UN official, Mr. Holmes, has just returned from a visit to the region. Finally, Tiger Woods is expected to return to golf for the Masters tournament at Augusta in April. That's out this morning from the Associated Press. Ratings estimates for that broadcast to follow. Let's look at some of the news stories we're following this morning. Coming up, we learn what else our listeners thought the nation of Haiti needs from America and the rest of the world. Your responses and your stories and your voices in just a few minutes.
What's your take? Leave a comment at thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
We have some takeouts on news stories that we're following right now. And, of course, there's lots of arguments, right, John, going on in D.C.? No dearth of arguments over the stimulus, new bills to help the unemployed.
Just landed in a big box right on my doorstep.
That's weird because that's what happened in Florida, too.
Really?
Kind of, yeah. They got like a big box, sort of.
It's sort of nobody can find
it, $1 billion.
Right.
So we actually sent someone down to Florida with you to check out how the stimulus money is being spent in Florida and really how people feel about the expenditures. We're joined now by Takeaway transportation reporter Colin Campbell. You went to Polk County. Why did you go to Polk County?
Well, Polk County is halfway between Orlando and Tampa, and it's kind of smack in the middle of a Florida high-speed rail route. So this is the big ticket of the stimulus. We talked a couple weeks ago about the projects you might remember from the stimulus. This could be one of them. It's a 90-mile train route, and Polk County's right in the middle. That train route's being paid for by more than $1 billion in stimulus money. And the project goes between Tampa and Orlando. It goes through Republican counties. It goes through purple parts of the country. These are the hard-fought areas of Florida politics. These are, where the narrative of whether the stimulus is working or not will be settled.
So, can I ride this rail?
You can't ride the rail until probably 2015, they hope, although there's sort of some cracks showing in it. But
they must be pretty happy about it there.
You would think, yeah. It's kind of a rural place with cows and oranges and strawberries. It's also a place with 13% unemployment. They need the money. And that's where I found Billy Gay. He's an immigrant from Costa Rica. I talked to him outside a diner in the morning. He was going to his truck where he was going to do some sod work, some grass work. He also works in a phosphate mine in Lakeland, Florida. And he's an Obama voter. He voted for Obama in 2008. And I asked him if he'd vote for Obama again. He said no. And I asked him what he thought of the stimulus. Here's what he told me.
I don't understand the stimulus money, the spending of the money, the way that they doing, and I don't think they're actually helping the small little guy like me.
Okay, so in Florida, they don't like the stimulus package because it's not trickling down to the local level. That's right?
I think they're waiting to see it. I think they're waiting to see it trickle down. The second person I talked to was a woman called Dina Stebbins DeCamp. She runs a custom embroidery business in Lakeland. Business is off 30%, and I think you would have thought Billy Gay there might have seen a little bit of stimulus money. Dina Stebbins DeCamp kind of looking around Lakeland to see the effects. Doesn't look good to her. She also runs the Republican Women's Club of Lakeland, so you'd expect she'd be a little skeptical of the Obama administration. And she's also an organizer of the Tea Party there.
Oh, well, geez.
So this is somebody you expect, if you believe what you see on TV, to be frothing at the mouth at the talk of $1 billion,
right?
A touchy-feely project like a high-speed train. Here's what she told me about the high-speed rail.
People are so desperate to pay their mortgages and keep their jobs, and the government's spending money that we really don't have yet. But we're actually very happy about the bullet train. We think it's a good thing for Florida.
Okay, so she's happy about the bullet train. So maybe they don't think it's getting out of the little guy, but they're happy about the big ticket projects.
I think they'd like to see the big ticket projects run in a financially responsible way. Dina gave me a couple other ideas. Stimulus money could go for tax cuts. It could go to things that they'd see a little quicker. The ambivalence about the stimulus funding could be leading to a little bit of ambivalence about the high-speed rail project itself. Which is a problem. It only covers 90 miles. This is something that the White House is trying to get done quickly, to really show off. This is stimulus money at work here, jobs. Here's a train you can ride. And so I found Troy Keener, a retired guy. He's kind of a lifelong resident of Polk County. He used to work for the DOT. This is the kind of guy you'd also expect to be pretty bullish on a train.
And what do you have to say?
And I asked him, would you ride the train? Here's what Troy said.
People's not going to pay the money to ride the train. I mean, only the rich and famous are going to be able to afford to do it. And then when they get there, how are they going to get off? They're going to get a cab? They pay a cab fare? No, I don't think so. I mean, how is they going to get around from the train station to where they want to go to? If I have to ride it to Orlando to go to Bass Pro Shop, I've got to catch a cab there. And I'm not paying a cab driver his fee to take me there and pick me up and take me back. I'd rather drive it.
Okay, so it sounds to me like the really what's at issue here is that Floridians themselves don't entirely agree on what it is that they want, which makes it very difficult for the Obama administration to address that with stimulus funds. But thanks, that's their takeaway transportation reporter Colin Campbell bringing us ambiguity from Florida.
Ambiguity from Florida. As Carl Hyacinth said, the epicenter of sleaze. Yes, indeed. So you've been responding all week long. What do people need in Haiti? Well, we've heard they need jobs already this hour, but what else?
My name is Charlie Florestal. I'm a Haitian American. What Haiti needs from the world right now, the only one thing Haiti needs is for the world to help end corruption in Haiti. Haiti is the most corrupted country in the world today.
My name is James. I'm calling from Pembroke Pines, Florida. What Haiti needs is education. As a first-generation Haitian American, the key to developing this nation is education.
My name is Regine Cambron with Baptist Health South Florida. We are the largest healthcare system in Florida. We are coordinating to assemble 1 million meals for Haiti.
Lots of clarity there from Floridians.
Specifics.
About what happens in Florida and what Florida needs or Haiti needs.
You can get more of our Haiti coverage at our site, thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, you can catch up on a story we brought you yesterday. 2010 could be the tipping point when there will be more babies of color than white babies born in the United States. This sparked a lively discussion among our listeners, what you think about the labels of majority and minority. We got some racial zen from Frank in New York.
There's a lot of fear, a lot of envy, jealousy around race and majority-minority. And so it's very important to stay focused. And what I would say is, listen, we're the drops of one ocean and the leaves of one tree, and then mankind is one.
Oh. Jennifer in Salt Lake City, though, she wanted to get at the greater issue of racism. And she writes that while being colorblind may be a long-term goal, it's not how we currently live in this country. Jennifer says we live in a society that's mostly unconsciously biased by people's skin color. Until we all become aware of this and consciously make change, we're going to continue to allow our systems and institutions to perpetuate racism.
Lots actually, of comments about that and other things at thetakeaway.org. You know how to reach us. Today's question, of course, is because of daylight savings time, what if you could expand the clock? What would you have more time for?
My name is Tony, and I'm driving across Iowa right now. And if I had an extra hour, I would spend it with my wife. Being the fact that I'm gone so much, I just miss to have the time with my wife.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable development in communities across the country. More at rockfound.org. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, a story out of graphic novels. Did you see The Watchmen or read the graphic novel, John?
Oh, sure.
You know the big line, who watches the Watchmen?
Mm-hmm.
Now imagine that instead of being superheroes, the Watchmen were congressmen.
Yeah. I would love blue congressmen who can fly. That would be interesting.
That would be interesting. Yeah. But the real question is, who's policing them? And the answer is, they are. They're policing themselves. We're going to talk about that and the House Ethics Committee in a moment. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Democrats are meeting today to iron out differences in a health care bill. President Obama says he wants it on his desk by next week. But House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says that's unlikely.
The March 18th is an interesting date. As I say, our clock starts ticking when we get the final CBO report.
Even after that, though, several procedural hurdles need to be cleared. Staying with health care news, new reports show the mandated health care coverage system in Massachusetts is expanding access for the state's Latino population. Earlier, we spoke to Robert Pomales of the Latin American Institute.
We have seen a significant increase in the number covered by insurance now. And that has certainly resulted in better connection to health care for the Latino population.
Yesterday, the president met with Black and Latino House caucuses.
After a long legal battle, a settlement's been reached for more than 10,000 rescue workers who say they got sick from the dust at Ground Zero after the 9/11 attacks in 2001. If they and a judge agree to the deal, the cops, firefighters, and construction workers would share up to $657 million. Learning more this morning about the collapse of Lehman Brothers, a new report shows the investment bank used accounting gimmicks like removing $50 billion from the balance sheet. Senior executives then approved those misleading financial statements in the weeks and days before Lehman Brothers vanished from the earth. The report also finds that Lehman Brothers had been insolvent for weeks before it filed for bankruptcy in September of 2008, helping to trigger the global financial crisis. More on this story in the next half hour from our partner, the BBC. And Hall of Famer Merlin Olsen, who helped form one of the NFL's greatest defensive lines before embarking on a successful career in television, died yesterday after a battle with cancer. He was 69. Olsen was a member of the Los Angeles Rams' fearsome foursome in the 1960s. He later starred on the TV series Little House on the Prairie. Let's check the markets now. Asian markets mixed. European indices up. Futures up. The Dow gets underway at 10,611. The S&P opens at 1,150. And the Nasdaq at 2,368.
Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
All this week, we've been talking about political dysfunction in New York, Illinois, and, of course, in Florida. But, you know, in Washington, D.C., of course, they generally have... yeah, they're the professionals.
Now they're saying I groped a male staffer. Yeah, I did.
That's, of course, Eric Massa, who claims he was not actually groping his staffers. He was tickling them as part of his birthday celebration. Needless to say, allegations of tickling or groping on the part of a congressman get the media talking. And that made another lawmaker, Patrick Kennedy, get really upset.
There's two press people in this gallery. We're talking about Eric Massa 24/7 on the TV.
But, you know, allegations of misconduct in Congress, they're not new, are they?
I committed no wrongdoing whatsoever.
You don't want to give up the perks of power, the chairmanships.
And I'm a high-profile person.
So why do we have so many scandals out of Washington? Isn't anybody looking into this, trying to prevent these things from happening? It's true, sitting congressmen can't be arrested, so who actually polices our lawmakers? Who watches Congress? Congress does, actually, and that could be part of the problem. The body that uses that Congress uses to police itself is the House Ethics Committee. Marion Wang is here to talk about this. She's a reporter and blogger for ProPublica. Good morning, Marion.
Good morning.
So just yesterday, the news is the House has decided to continue their investigation into former Democratic New York Congressman Eric Massa. He resigned on Monday. But what are they investigating?
Well, what I think they're investigating this time is actually for the situation and the handling of, you know, the investigation around Massa to be investigated. So I think what John Boehner was asking for yesterday was that, particularly with House Democrats, how they handled it, what they knew, when they knew it, and whether there was any cover-up involved.
Whether or not Massa was forced out, you mean?
Well, actually, with Nancy Pelosi's office, when did they know about the allegations and what did they do? Did they do nothing? And it's the same type of investigation that actually happened around Mark Foley in 2006. Just when the tables were turned, the minority party wanted to know how the majority had handled it when one of their own was, you know, under investigation.
So the House Ethics Committee, we don't always know exactly what happens in there. They're a relatively secretive body.
That's right.
So do we only know what they come out to the podium and announce during press conferences?
You know, pretty much. The committee had actually been investigating Massa for a month before media reports started coming out about the investigation, at which point they came out and said, yes, we are investigating him, but they really didn't address any of the allegations. So it was just a one-line statement. And that's typically how they operate.
Okay, well, let's bring John Bresnahan into this conversation. He's the senior congressional reporter for Politico. John, you've actually been covering the House Ethics Committee for years, and would you say that this is a fairly dysfunctional entity?
I would say it can be completely dysfunctional. There were years when it did very little publicly in terms of policing members. For a while there in the early 2000s, basically Congress ceded authority or ceded a lot of authority to the Justice Department, which actually charged a bunch of members. So, yeah, there are times when it doesn't work. They've tried to make reforms. They work intermittently. It's a very difficult situation for members.
Well, now, the House Ethics Committee is there as a body to investigate allegations of misconduct on the part of congressmen, because congressmen are exempt, as I said earlier, from arrest, except in the cases of something like a felony.
Well, they can be arrested. They can't be arrested while they're voting.
In attendance.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Or on their way to Congress or
exactly.
Something like that. So how efficiently do they perform that duty? Are they a good watchdog, or is this a political tool?
No, they're not a good watchdog, generally speaking. A lot of what the Ethics Committee, their official name is the Committee on Standards of Official Conduct, is mundane. They review financial disclosure reports. They give advice on trips or gifts. I mean, they do a lot behind the scenes. In terms of actually charging members, investigating members, the problem is they're not a law enforcement body. And members don't want to serve on the Ethics Committee. They do it because they're asked to. It's an onerous duty. But the problem is they imagine themselves sitting where a member under investigation is, and that just scares the heck out of them. So that they tend to look for ways out of problems, and they're very slow and they're very secretive. I've been covering it for years. Once in a while, you'll get a leak. There was a leaked document last year by the Washington Post that they got by a staff member, mistakenly put on the internet somewhere, and somebody grabbed it and leaked it to the Post, and it showed a bunch of stuff that was going on behind the scenes, but you never really see it. It's very difficult to know what's going on.
But are they fair? We have two congressmen who are under investigation, Eric Massa and Charlie Rangel. Are they both being treated the same in the Ethics Committee?
Well, Massa technically himself is no longer under investigation. The Ethics Committee has no jurisdiction over somebody who doesn't belong to Congress. Now, Rangel would probably argue after he's been admonished by the committee, it's the least severe penalty they could have, but he's still under investigation for a bunch of other stuff. He didn't think what they did was fair to him because they admonished him and let a couple other members off for the exact same thing. I think they bend over too far, to be fair. And the problem was in the 90s, it became a battleground. It became a political battleground. Members were just filing complaints against each other and outside groups. And then they reformed the rules so that no outside groups could file a complaint. And since that time, for the last decade or more than the last decade, the committee has really, it's had a very difficult time.
John Brezner,
incredible.
John Bresnahan is a senior congressional reporter for Politico, talking about the House Ethics Committee and its, working dysfunction.
So a sports story for the next couple of minutes. And sports fans, this Sunday, you may not know it, but if you tune in to watch a particular boxing match taking place down in Arlington, Texas, you may actually be witnessing the largest candidate town meeting event in the history of global politics. That's right. When WBO welterweight champion Manny Pacquiao defends his title, he's also going to be running for office back in his home country, the Philippines. Steve Farhood, boxing analyst for Showtime, has met Manny Pacquiao and is here to preview the weekend's action. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. How are you, John?
I love the town meeting aspect, but most people are tuning in for the boxing, of course, right?
I hope so, and it better be good boxing at that price, let me tell you.
What is the pay-per-view price?
I believe it's $49 or $55, but Manny Pacquiao is very exciting, consistently exciting, so people usually get their money's worth.
No, and in fact, that's really the driver here. Pacquiao is an exciting fighter to watch. He's something that the boxing game really, really needs right now. Who's he up against, and what are his chances?
Well, he's up against Josh Clotty, who's a fighter from Ghana, who's a legitimate contender, but unfortunately, it's really it's not the fight we wanted to see. We wanted to see Pacquiao against Floyd Mayweather, who's unbeaten and was the pound-for-pound best fighter in the world until a brief retirement. So we're hoping still that fight will materialize. Because that's the fight that would really help boxing. But in the meantime, this is Pacquiao staying busy and Mayweather staying busy with his own fight in a month or two.
And the Pacquiao match, we should note, is on Saturday, not
exactly.
Sunday. Style of these two fighters, and of course the Mayweather issue, it's natural for the big match to be sort of dangled out there, especially when you can get these like $55 a pop pay-per-view fees. Is this stylistically a good match, even though it's not the one everyone wants?
Yeah, it's almost impossible with Pacquiao not to have a pleasing match stylistically because he's aggressive, he's a big puncher, and Clotty is a puncher as well, a little bit slow and ponderous, but a very aggressive fighter, not a boxer and a mover. So style-wise, it should be very pleasing.
The fascinating thing about the Pacquiao, though, is that unlike a lot of fighters, he's really worked out what he's going to be doing after he leaves the ring, right?
Oh, God. He is amazing. He's a professional singer. He's been in action movies in the Philippines. The country idolizes him. It virtually stops every time he fights. And, of course, he's running for a congressional seat for the second time, I might add, in the Philippines. And, John, the irony of it is, from what I hear, the reason he lost the first time and the reason he's expected to lose, at least by prognosticators this time, is because the people love him as a fighter. And as much as they love him, they don't want to lose him as a fighter.
So no matter how good he is, he can't win, right?
Exactly. If he wins in the ring, he's probably going to lose in the congressional seat because his people back home will want to see him fight Mayweather.
So, Steve, we've got to figure out a bumper sticker for Pacquiao here. So what can he say? I'll still fight. Don't worry. Elect me or something like
Or I can't win for winning, something like that. Exactly.
I'll never lose my left hook.
Right.
Finally, is this a power fighter or a finesse fighter, Manny Pacquiao, for people who haven't seen him?
He's a very exciting action fighter, I put it that way. He's a power puncher. He scores a lot of knockouts, but he brings his speed, and he's become a tremendous, tremendous fighter, someone who the experts are saying now is among the greatest, not only of his day, but of all time.
Indeed. Steve Farhood, boxing analyst for Showtime. $55 a pop. If you've got it, spend it on the match on Saturday night. It's scheduled to rain in a lot of places around the country. Manny Pacquiao is defending his welterweight championship.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning and happy Friday. I'm Celeste Headley. I'm here with John Hockenberry. And, you know, in order to be a genius, technically you have to have an IQ of somewhere around 140, at least 140 points. Supposedly, there's only one in every 400 people who qualify. So if you believe in IQs, how come there's so few geniuses if it's possible for all of us to be a genius, as David Shank asserts?
We don't want everybody in this club. No way.
Oh, are you in that club?
No, that's what are you hearing me say? 190.
We're going to talk about how to become
307.
A genius.
307, that's my IQ.
In a moment. First, let's take a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Democratic House leaders are continuing to outline the health care reform package to lawmakers in their own party. Speaker Nancy Pelosi says the president wants the bill on his desk next week, but that may be a little early.
It may take longer. And we will take up the bill when we're ready to take up the bill.
Various procedural hurdles are still yet to be cleared.
All these people in Washington are starting to sound like doctors. It'll take a little longer, you know, just hang in there.
When we're ready.
Right, exactly. Some new information now. Lehman Brothers, we thought it was too big to fail. Turns out on paper it may have barely existed at the time it filed for bankruptcy. BBC economics correspondent Andrew Walker joins us now from London. Good morning, Andrew.
Morning.
There's a new report which really shows that if you're looking at balance sheets at Lehman Brothers, there wasn't much there to fail at the time that it even filed for bankruptcy. What do we have?
We have a bank that indeed had been doing its accounts in a way that gave what the report found to be a misleading impression of its financial condition. There are some particular transactions that were made in the course of 2008 that were designed, according to the report by an American attorney, to make its borrowings in relation to its capital, shareholders' capital, look more moderate than in truth they were. And the conclusion is that that there might actually even be a case for legal action to recover compensation from some former executives, including the former CEO, Dick Fuld,
sure,
and also from the auditors, the accountancy firm Ernst & Young. So, you know, and there are some uncomfortable echoes, I think, there of what happened with Enron, because, of course, that absolutely trashed the reputation of its auditors, the accountancy firm Arthur Andersen.
Couple of quick mind-boggling details. How do you erase $50 billion? And what is Repo 105 in the report?
Well, the idea of that is that a repo is where you sell some financial asset to somebody else and make a commitment to buy it back at some stage in the future. And the point for doing this in this particular case was that the week or so of that contract was a period when Lehman's quarterly balance sheet was being worked out. And that meant that there were a bunch of assets off its balance sheet on the key day, which just made it look a little bit less precarious than in truth it was. That was what it was all about. And interestingly, there's also you may be surprised to know there is a British angle on this story, because Lehman wanted a bit of legal cover for this, couldn't get an American lawyer to sign off to give an opinion saying this was okay. So they came over here and got it from a London firm, Freshfields.
Yes, there we go. That's right. I get my tax form signed off by a British lawyer every year.
And I think I got the name of the lawyers wrong, but it was a British firm of lawyers that gave them the legal cover for doing this.
Nice.
All right, Andrew Walker, economics correspondent for our partner, the BBC. How bad was it at Lehman? Even worse than you think. Finally, lost time. We're thinking about it because daylight savings begins on Sunday. You'll lose an hour of sleep, but what if you could gain an hour, a month, a week? What would you do with that time?
This is Bill from Rhode Island. I think the better question is not what we need another hour for, but I think we have enough time in the day. I think it's a matter of what can we shed that's not necessary to free up more time. I think we'd all be a lot happier that way.
Interesting.
Give us your story, 877-8MY-TAKE or post at thetakeaway.org. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Super genius.
What is genius?
Putting a man on the moon or inventing the internet.
I got a lot of PhD types and smart people around me.
The genius.
A stroke of genius.
Of the crowd.
A true musical genius.
Nature versus nurture.
The way he plays the game, he's just a genius out there in the court.
The American dream is to be able to make a living with what you are a genius at.
We have been talking about genius all week long, and David Shank is back with us. He wrote the new book, The Genius in All of Us. And David, bear with me here. Let's talk about what we've learned so far this week. What separates a genius from the rest of us is really not so much. We have the possibility, the capability, all of us do, to become a genius, right?
Right. It's our genes. We are not doomed to mediocrity by our genes. Our genes are actually built to adapt to our life circumstances and what we demand of them and what we demand of our bodies and brains.
Right.
With
we
hard
can
work.
We can reprogram our genes if we want to. And that's your whole thesis is that genius is a process and practice.
Absolutely.
And you have to have the drive to want to do this.
Absolutely.
Right. But you also mentioned that in some cases people talk about the 10,000 hours of practice.
Well, it takes a long time. No one's saying this is easy. And it also requires extraordinary sacrifice to be truly great at something. Not just time, but relationships, tremendous energy, and cost, money. John knows all this already, but you know the rest of us have to learn.
We're going to get a spin. We're going to get a call from his wife here in a moment if you keep doing that. But you know, let's talk a little bit about that sacrifice because you know I've known a few geniuses in my life, and not only do they have to sacrifice, but if they are married, if they have children, the other people in their life have to sacrifice when you have somebody that dedicated to something.
Right. So the lesson here is not that everyone should, you know, give up everything to become, you know, a Mozart or a Sarah Chang or whatever. The lesson here is that you're not doomed to mediocrity. Put that excuse aside and decide how great you want to be and what sacrifices you want to make. And I'm not saying this is all in your control, but it is more in your control and in your family's control than you think. So make the decision about how great you want to be and what you want to give to that ambition.
And throw away your copy of The Bell Curve, which said that we are all doomed to be what our genes programmed us for.
Please do.
Well, let's bring in Jenny Nile. She's founder and head of the school at the E.L. Haynes Public Charter School in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Jenny.
Good morning. How are you guys this morning?
I'm doing well, thanks. We're talking to you because your school has been very successful at doing some of the things that David talks about in his book, in finding the talents in each of your students and developing them. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. I mean, the foundational components of what David's written about is actually how we've organized the whole school. And it really has profound implications for education and how we need to have schools organized to make sure that every single child is ready to go to college and is ready to be as successful as possible.
Okay, but you had a lottery at your school last week, and you had to turn away a lot of disappointed parents. I mean, not everybody can get into a school that's going to do that for them and structure it for them. So give me some tips. How does one, with your child or with yourself, how do you go about doing this?
Yep. You know, I was looking again at David's book because I had jotted some notes even before then, and I think he really sums it up incredibly powerfully. I mean, the first piece is believe. Believe that this is actually possible. And this is what all parents need to believe about their kids, is not that they have something that if they're, small, they can't be a great athlete or whatever it is. They need to actually believe in that potential and that the possibility of genius. The second piece really is that I think a key point about supporting the child but not making it so that they're living vicariously through the child. We've all seen stories of this.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
Certainly well documented in various movies and in tabloids. But parents need, they can't link rewarding kids with their love and affection for success, and thus withholding it for failure, because parents need to provide that unconditional love for children, regardless of their success or failure. And that also builds into that next one, which is you've got to be able to, as a parent, help kids learn how to practice. And in fact, it's not just a generic kind of practice. You need to think about a specific way of practicing that actually builds the skills. And then I think the last one is crucial for all parents, which is regard failure as something that kids can learn from. It's not the end of the world, and the sooner that our students and that our young people and that your sons and daughters know that, the better it is, and the more sturdy they'll be as a person and the more resilient.
That's great advice. You know, David, in this whole book, there's a kind of a singular genius that you knock down, but there's a collective genius that seems to replace it. Is that the lesson here? And there's a scientific basis for that collective genius, working together, bringing out people's potential.
Well, I think that's right. And I think, you know, one of the really important points here is that culture has so much to do with this. So it's not just about you and your child and what you guys can do. It's about this. And this isn't just a short-term thing. This isn't about one lifetime. This is about building over many, many generations this idea that we can do better, that there isn't a whole population that's just kind of doomed to inferior achievement, that if we believe more in ourselves and we apply the principles that some of us have learned, that we can get there.
Okay, David Schenck is the author of The Genius in All of Us. It's the concept we've been talking about all week long. And we also spoke with Jenny Now. She's the founder and head of the school at the E.L. Haynes Public Charter School.
I want to go there.
In Washington, D.C. I don't want to go back to school. You can read more about the Genius series on our website, thetakeaway.org.
And David, before we go, if you had an extra hour of daylight savings time, what would you do with it?
Well, I want 2 hours, one for sleep and one for practice.
All right. That's great. Practice what?
Mandolin at the moment.
Oh, nice.
Fantastic. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.